against his chest. His heart was beating like trapped wings. "Take me home, then," she whispered, and she leaned up to brush her lips against the corner of his mouth. Or at least she meant it as a brush, a butterfly touch of lips on lips. But he leaned down toward her, and his movement changed the angle swiftly. She pressed up against him harder than she'd meant to, her lips sliding to center against his. She felt him breathe out in surprise against her mouth, and then they were kissing, really kissing, exquisitely slow and hot and intense. "Take me home." But this was home, Jace's arms surrounding her, the cold wind of Alicante in their clothes, her fingers digging into the back of his neck, the place where his hair curled softly against his skin. His palms were still flat against the stone behind her, but he moved his body against hers, gently pressing her up against the wall. She could hear the harsh undertone of his breathing. He wouldn't touch her with his hands, but she could touch him. She let her hands go freely, over the swell of his arms, down to his chest, tracing the ridges of muscles, pressing outward to grip his sides until his t-shirt was rucking up under her fingers. Her fingertips touched bare skin, and then she was sliding her hands up under his shirt. And she hadn't touched him like this in so long, had nearly forgotten how his skin was soft where it wasn't scarred, how the muscles in his back jumped under her touch. He gasped into her mouth. He tasted like tea and chocolate and salt. She had taken control of the kiss. Now she felt him tense as he took it back, biting her lower lip until she shuddered, nipping at the corner of her mouth, kissing along her jawbone to suck at the pulse point at her throat, swallowing her racing heartbeat. His skin burned under her hands, burned. He broke away, reeling back almost drunkenly, hitting the opposite wall. His eyes were wide, and for a dizzy moment, Clary thought she could see flames in them, like twin fires in the darkness. Then the light went out of them, and he was only gasping as if he had been running, pressing the heels of his palms against his face. "Jace," she said. He dropped his hands. "Look at the wall behind you," he said in a flat voice. She turned and stared. Behind her, where he had been leaning, were twin scorch marks in the stone, in the exact shape of his hands.
The Sealy Queen lay upon her bed and looked up at the stone ceiling of her bedchamber. It was wreathed with dangling trellises of roses, thorns still intact, each one perfect and blood red. Every night they withered and died, and every morning they were replaced, as fresh as the day before. Fairy slept little and rarely dreamed, but the queen liked her bed to be comfortable. It was a wide couch of stone, with a feather mattress laid on top, and covered with thick swaths of velvet and slippery satin. "Have you ever," said the boy in the bed beside her, "pricked yourself on one of the thorns, Your Majesty?" She turned to look at Jonathan Morgenstern, sprawled among the covers. Though he had asked her to call him Sebastian, which she respected, no fairy would allow another to address them by their true name, either. He was on his stomach, head pillowed on his crossed arms, and even in the dim light, the old whip wheels across his back were visible. The queen had always been fascinated by shadow hunters. They were part angel, as were the fair folk. Certainly there should be a kinship between them, but had never thought she would find one whose personality she could stand for more than 5 minutes, until Sebastian. They were also dreadfully self-righteous. Not Sebastian. He was most unusual for a human, and for a shadow hunter especially. "Not so often as you cut yourself on your wit, I think, my dearest," she said. "You know I do not wish to be called Your Majesty, but only Lady, or My Lady, if you must. You do not seem to mind when I call you Beautiful One, or My Beautiful Lady." His tone was not repentant. "Hmm," she said, raking her slim fingers through the mass of his silvery hair. He had lovely coloring for a mortal, hair like a blade, eyes like onyx. She recalled his sister, so very different, not nearly so elegant. "Was your sleep refreshing? Are you weary?" He rolled over onto his back and grinned up at her. Not quite spent, I think. She leaned to kiss him, and he reached up to twine his fingers in her red hair. He looked at a curl of it, scarlet against the scarred skin of his knuckles, and touched the curl to his cheek. Before she could speak another word, a knock came at the door of her bedchamber. The queen called out, "What is it? If it's not a matter of importance, be off with you, or I shall have you fed to the Nixies in the river." The door opened, and one of the younger court ladies came in, Kaylee Whitewillow, a pixie. She curtsied and said, "My lady, Meliorn is here, and would speak with you." Sebastian quirked a pale eyebrow. A queen's work is never done. The queen sighed and rolled from the bed. "Bring him in," she said, "and bring me one of my dressing gowns as well, for the air is chill." Kaylee nodded and left the room. A moment later, Meliorn entered and bowed his head. If Sebastian thought it odd that the queen greeted her courtiers standing naked in the middle of her bedchamber, he did not evince it by any quirk of expression. A mortal woman would have been embarrassed, might have tried to cover herself. But the queen was the queen, eternal and proud, and she knew she was as glorious out of clothes as she was in them. "Meliorn," she said, "you have news from the Nephilim." He straightened. Meliorn wore, as he usually did, white armor in a design of overlapping scales. His eyes were green, and his hair was very long and black. "My lady," he said, and glanced behind her at Sebastian, who was sitting up on the bed, the coverlet tangled around his waist. "I have much news. Our new forces of Dark Ones have been situated at the fortress of Edom. They await for their orders." "And the Nephilim?" the queen asked as Kaylee came back into the room carrying a dressing gown woven of the petals of lilies. She held it up, and the queen slipped into it, wrapping the silken whiteness about herself. "The children who escaped the Los Angeles Institute have given enough information that they know that Sebastian is behind the attacks," said Meliorn, rather sourly. "They would have guessed it anyway," said Sebastian. "They do have a regrettable habit of blaming me for everything." "The question is, were our people identified?" the queen demanded. "They were not," said Meliorn with satisfaction. "The children assumed all the attackers to be Endarkened." "That is impressive, considering the presence of fairy blood in that Blackthorn boy," said Sebastian. "One might have thought they'd be attuned to it. What are you planning on doing with him anyway?" "He has fairy blood. He is ours," said Meliorn. "Gwen has claimed him to join the Wild Hunt. He will be dispatched there." He turned to the queen. "We have need of more soldiers," he said. "The institutes are emptying. The Nephilim are fleeing to Idris." "What of the New York Institute?" Sebastian demanded sharply. "What of my brother and sister?" "Clary Frey and Jace Lightwood have been sent to Idris," said Meliorn. "We cannot attempt to retrieve them quite yet without showing our hand." Sebastian touched the bracelet on his wrist. It was a habit of his the queen had noted, something he did when he was angry and trying not to show it. The metal was written on in an old language of humans. "If I cannot reach heaven, I will raise hell." "I want them," he said. "And you shall have them," said the queen. "I have not forgotten that was part of our bargain. But you must be patient." Sebastian smiled, though it did not reach his eyes. "We mortals can be over hasty." "You are no ordinary mortal," said the queen, and turned back to Meliorn. "My knight," she said, "what do you advise your queen?" "We need more soldiers," Meliorn said. "We must take another institute. More weapons would be a boon as well." "I thought you said all the shadow hunters were in Idris," Sebastian said. "Not quite yet," said Meliorn. "Some cities have taken longer than expected to evacuate all the Nephilim. The shadow hunters of London, Rio de Janeiro, Cairo, Istanbul and Taipei remain. We must have at least one more institute. Sebastian smiled. It was the sort of smile that transformed his lovely face, not into something lovelier, but into a cruel mask, all teeth, like a manticore's grin. "Then I shall have London," he said, "if that does not go against your wishes, my queen." She could not help but smile. It had been so many centuries since a mortal lover had made her smile. She bent to kiss him, and felt his hand slide over the petals of her gown. "Take London, my love, and turn it all to blood," she said. "My gift to you."
"You're all right," Jace asked, for what felt to Clary like the 100th time. She was standing on the front step of Armitage's house, partly illuminated by the lights from the windows. Jace was just below her, his hands jammed into his pockets as if he were afraid to let them free. He had stared at the burn marks he'd made on the wall of the shop for a long time before tugging his shirt down and practically yanking Clary out into the crowded street as if she shouldn't be alone with him. He'd been taciturn the rest of the way home, his mouth set in a tense line. "I'm fine," she assured him. "Look, you burn the wall, not me." She did an exaggerated twirl as if she was showing off a new outfit. "See?" There were shadows in his eyes. "If I hurt you..." "You didn't," she said. "I'm not that fragile. I thought I was getting better at controlling it, that working with Jordan was helping." Frustration curled through his voice. "You are, it is. Look, you were able to concentrate the fire in your hands, that's progress. I was touching you, kissing you, and I'm not hurt." She put her hand against his cheek. "We worked through this together, remember? No shutting me out, no epic sulks." "I was figuring I could sulk for Idris in the next Olympics," Jay said, but his voice was already softening, the edge of hard self-loathing filed away, wryness and amusement taking its place. "You and Alec could go for parasulking," said Clary with a smile. "You'd get the gold." He turned his head and kissed the palm of her hand. His hair brushed the tops of her fingers. Everything around them seemed still and quiet. Clary could almost believe they were the only people in Alicante. "I keep wondering," he said against her skin, "what the guy who owns that store is going to think when he comes to work in the morning and sees two handprints burned into his wall." "I hope I have insurance for this." Jace laughed, a small puff of air against her hand. "Speaking of which," said Clary, "the next council meeting is tomorrow, right?" Jace nodded. "War council," he said. "Only select members of the Clave." He wiggled his fingers irritably. Clary felt his annoyance. Jace was an excellent strategist and one of the Clave's best fighters and would have greatly resented being left out of any meeting that was about battles. Especially, she thought, if there was going to be discussion about using the heavenly fire as a weapon. "Then maybe you could help me out with something. I need an armaments shop. I want to buy a sword, a really good one." Jace looked surprised, then amused. "What for?" "Oh, you know, killing." Clary made a hand gesture she hoped conveyed her murderous intentions towards all things evil. "I mean, I've been a shadow hunter for a while now. I should have a proper weapon, right?" A slow grin spread across his face. "The best blade shop is Diana's on Flintlock Street," he said, eyes alight. "I'll pick you up tomorrow afternoon." "It's a date," Clary said. "A weapons date." "So much better than dinner and a movie," he said, and disappeared into the shadows. 5. Measure of Revenge. Maya looked up as the door to Jordan's apartment banged open and he raced inside, almost skidding on the slippery hardwood floor. "Anything?" he asked. She shook her head. His face fell. After they'd killed the Indarkens, she'd called the pack to come help them deal with the mess. Unlike demons, Indarkens didn't just evaporate when you killed them. Disposal was required. Normally, they would have summoned the Shadow Hunters and Silent Brothers, but the doors to the Institute and the Bone City were closed now. Instead, Bat and the rest of the pack had showed up with a body bag, while Jordan, still bleeding from the fight with the Indarkand, had gone to look for Simon. He hadn't come back for hours, and when he had, the look in his eyes had told Maya the whole story. He had found Simon's phone, smashed to pieces, abandoned at the bottom of the fire escape like a mocking note. Otherwise, there'd be no sign of him at all. Neither of them had slept after that, of course. Maya had gone back to Wolfpack headquarters with Bat, who had promised, if a little hesitantly, that he would tell the wolves to look for Simon and try, emphasis on try, to reach the shadow hunters in Alicante. There were lines open to the shadow hunter capital, lines that only the heads of packs and clans could use. Maya had returned to Jordan's apartment at dawn, despairing and exhausted. She was standing in the kitchen when he came in, a wet paper towel pressed to her forehead. She took it away as Jordan looked at her and felt the water run down her face like tears. "No," she said, "no news." Jordan slumped against the wall. He was wearing only a short-sleeved t-shirt and the ink designs of lines from the Upanishads were darkly visible around his biceps. His hair was sweaty, plastered to his forehead, and there was a red line on his neck where the strap of his weapons pack had cut into the skin. He looked miserable. "I can't believe this," he said, for what felt to Maya like the millionth time. "I lost him, I was responsible for him, and I goddamn lost him." "It's not your fault." She knew it wouldn't make him feel any better, but she couldn't help saying it. "Look, you can't fight off every vampire and baddie in the tri-state area, and the Praetor shouldn't have asked you to try. When Simon lost the mark, you asked for backup, didn't you? And they didn't send anyone, you did what you could." Jordan looked down at his hands and said something under his breath. "Not good enough." Maya knew she should go over to him, put her arms around him, comfort him. Tell him he wasn't to blame. But she couldn't. The weight of guilt was as heavy on her chest as an iron bar, words unsaid choking her throat. It had been that way for weeks now. "Jordan, I have to tell you something. Jordan, I have to... Jordan, I... Jordan..." The sound of a ringing phone cut through the silence between them. Almost frantically, Jordan dug into his pocket and yanked his mobile out. He flipped it open as he put it to his ear. "Hello?" Maya watched him, leaning so far forward that the countertop cut into her ribcage. She could hear only murmurs on the other end of the phone, though, and was nearly screaming with impatience by the time Jordan closed the phone and looked over at her, a spark of hopefulness in his eyes. "That was Teal Waxelbaum, second in command at the Praetor," he said. "They want me at headquarters right away. I think they're going to help look for Simon. Will you come? If we head out now, we should be there by noon." There was a plea in his voice under the current of anxiety about Simon. He wasn't stupid, Maya thought. He knew something was wrong. He knew. She took a deep breath. The words crowded her throat. "Jordan, we have to talk about something." But she forced them back down. Simon was the priority now. "Of course," she said. "Of course, I'll come."
The first thing Simon saw was the wallpaper, which wasn't that bad. A bit dated. Definitely peeling. Serious mold problem. But overall, not the worst thing he'd ever opened his eyes to. He blinked once or twice, taking in the heavy stripes that cut through the floral pattern. It took him a second to realize that those stripes were, in fact, bars. He was in a cage. He quickly rolled onto his back and stood, not checking to see how high the cage was. His skull made contact with the bars on top, knocking his gaze downward as he cursed out loud. And then he saw himself. He was wearing a flowing, puffy white shirt. Even more troubling was the fact that he also appeared to be wearing a pair of very tight leather pants. Very tight, very leather. Simon looked down at himself and took it all in. The billows of the shirt, the deep, chest-exposing V, the tightness of the leather. "Why is it," he said after a moment, "that whenever I think I've found the most terrible thing that could happen to me, I'm always wrong?" As if on cue, the door opened, and a tiny figure rushed into the room. A dark shape closed the door instantly behind her, with Secret Service-like speed. She tiptoed up to the cage and squeezed her face between two bars.
Simon, she breathed.
Maureen. Simon would normally have at least tried to ask her to let him out, to find a key, to assist him. But something in Maureen's appearance told him that would not be helpful. Specifically, the crown of bones she was wearing. Finger bones. Maybe foot bones. And the bone crown was bejeweled, or possibly bedazzled. And then there was the ragged rose and gray ball gown, widened at the hips in a style that reminded him of those costume dramas set in the 18th century. It was not the kind of outfit that inspired confidence.
"Hey, Maureen," he said cautiously.
Maureen smiled and pressed her face harder into the opening.
"Do you like your outfit?" she asked. "I have a few for you. I got you a frock coat and a kilt and all kinds of stuff. But I wanted you to wear this one first. I did your makeup, too. That was me."
Simon didn't need a mirror to know he was wearing eyeliner. The knowledge was instant and complete.
"Maureen, I'm making you a necklace," she said, cutting him off. "I want you to wear more jewelry. I want you to wear more bracelets. I want things around your wrists."
"Maureen, where am I?"
"You're with me."
"Okay. Where are we?"
"The hotel, the hotel, the hotel."
The Hotel du Mort. At least that made some kind of sense.
"Okay," he said.
"And why am I in a cage?"
Maureen started humming a song to herself and ran her hand along the bars of the cage, lost in her own world. "Together, together, together. Now we're together. You and me, Simon and Maureen, finally."
"Maureen,
this will be your room," she said. "And once you're ready, you can come out. I've got things for you. I've got a bed and other things, some chairs, things you'll like, and the band can play."
She twirled, almost losing her balance under the strange weight of the dress. Simon felt he should probably choose his next words very carefully. He knew he had a calming voice. He could be sensitive, reassuring.
"Maureen, you know, I like you." On this, Maureen stopped spinning and gripped the bars again. "You just need time," she said with a terrifying kindness in her voice. "Just time. You'll learn. You'll fall in love. We're together now. And we'll rule. You and me. We will rule my kingdom, now that I'm queen."
"Queen."
"Queen. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen of the night. Queen Maureen of the darkness. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen of the dead."
She took a candle that burned in a sconce on the wall and suddenly poked it between the bars and in Simon's general direction. She tipped it ever so slightly and smiled as the white wax dropped in tear-like forms to the rotted remains of the scarlet carpet on the floor. She bit her lower lip in concentration, turning her wrist gently, pooling the drips together.
"You're a queen?" Simon said faintly. He'd known Maureen was the leader of the New York vampire clan. She'd killed Camille, after all, and taken her place. But clan leaders weren't called kings or queens. They dressed normally, like Raphael did, not in costumey get-ups. They were important figures in the community of the Knight's Children. But Maureen, of course, was different. Maureen was a child, an undead child. Simon remembered her rainbow arm warmers, her little breathy voice, her big eyes. She'd been a little girl with all the innocence of a little girl when Simon had bitten her, when Camille and Lilith had taken her and changed her, injecting an evil into her veins that had taken all that innocence and corrupted it into madness. It was his fault, Simon knew. If Maureen hadn't known him, hadn't followed him around, none of this would have happened to her. Maureen nodded and smiled, concentrating on her wax pile, which was now looking like a tiny volcano.
"I need to do things," she said abruptly, and dropped the candle still burning.
It snuffed itself out as it hit the ground, and she bustled toward the door. The same dark figure opened it the instant she approached. And then Simon was alone again, with the smoking remains of the candle and his new leather pants, and the horrible weight of his guilt.
Maya had been silent the whole way to the Prater, as the sun had risen higher in the sky and the surroundings had turned from the crowded buildings of Manhattan to the traffic-clogged Long Island Expressway to the pastoral small towns and farms of the Norfolk. They were close to the Prater now, and could see the ice-blue waters of the Sound on their left rippling in the cool wind. Maya imagined plunging into them and shuddered at the thought of the cold. "Are you all right?" Jordan had hardly spoken most of the way either. It was chilly inside his truck, and he wore leather driving gloves, but they didn't conceal his white-knuckle grip on the wheel. Maya could feel the anxiety rolling off him in waves. "I'm fine," she said. It wasn't true. She was worried about Simon, and she was still fighting the words she couldn't say that choked her throat. Now wasn't the right time to say them, not with Simon missing, and yet every moment she didn't say them felt like a lie. They swung onto the long white drive that stretched into the distance toward the Sound. Jordan cleared his throat. "You know I love you, right?" "I know," Maya said quietly, and fought the urge to say thank you. You weren't supposed to say thank you when someone said they loved you. You were supposed to say what Jordan was clearly expecting. She looked out the window and started, jerked out of her reverie. "Jordan, is it snowing?" "I don't think so." But white flakes were drifting past the windows of the truck, building up on the windshield. Jordan brought the truck to a stop and rolled one of the windows down, opening his hand to catch a flake. He drew it back, his expression darkening. "That's not snow," he said. "That's ash." Maya's heart lurched as he shoved the truck back into gear and they pitched forward, spinning around the corner of the drive. Up ahead of them, where the Prater Lupus headquarters had been rising, gold against the gray noon sky, was a gout of black smoke. Jordan swore and slewed the wheel to the left. The truck bumped into a ditch and sputtered out. He kicked his door open and jumped down. Maya followed a second later. The Prater Lupus headquarters had been built on a huge parcel of green land that sloped down to the Sound. The central building was built of golden stone, a Romanesque manor house surrounded by arched porticos. Or it had been. It was a mass of smoking wood and stone now, charred like bones in a crematorium. White powder and ashes blew thickly across the gardens, and Maya choked on the stinging air, bringing a hand up to shield her face. Jordan's brown hair was thickly snowflaked with ash. He stared around them, his expression shocked and uncomprehending. "I don't..." Something caught Maya's eye, a flicker of movement through the smoke. She grabbed Jordan's sleeve. "Look, there's someone there." He took off, skirting the smoking ruin of the Prater building. Maya followed him, though she couldn't help but hang back in horror, staring at the charred remnants of the structure that protruded from the earth. Walls holding up a no longer existing roof, windows that had been blown out or melted, glimpses here and there of white that could have been brick or bones. Jordan stopped ahead of her. Maya moved up to stand beside him. Ash was clinging to her shoes, the grit of it in among the laces. She and Jordan were in the main body of the burned-out buildings. She could see the water in the near distance. The fire hadn't spread, though there were charred dead leaves and blowing ash here, too. And in among the clipped hedgerows, there were bodies. Werewolves of all ages, though mostly young, lay sprawled along the manicured paths, their bodies being slowly covered by ash as if they were being swallowed by a blizzard. Werewolves had an instinct to surround themselves with others of their kind, to live in packs, to draw strength from one another. This many dead lycanthropes felt like a tearing ache, a hole of loss in the world. She remembered the words from Kipling, written on the walls of the Prater. "For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack." Jordan was gazing around, his lips moving as he murmured the names of the dead. "Andrea, Teal, Ammon, Grosh, Mara." At the edge of the water, Maya suddenly saw something move, a body half submerged. She broke into a run, Jordan on her heels, She skidded through the ash to where the grass gave way to sand and dropped down beside the corpse. It was Praetor Scott, corpse bobbing face down, his grey blonde hair soaked, the water around him stained pinkish red. Maya bent down to turn him over and nearly gagged. His eyes were open, staring sightlessly at the sky, his throat sliced wide open. Maya. She felt a hand on her back. Jordan's. Don't. His sentence was cut off by a gasp, and she whirled around, only to find a sense of horror so intense that it nearly blacked out her vision. Jordan stood behind her, one hand outstretched, a look of utter shock on his face. From the center of his chest protruded the blade of a sword, its metal stamped with black stars. It looked utterly bizarre, as if someone had taped it there, or as if it was some sort of theatrical prop. Blood began to spread out in a circle around it, staining the front of his jacket. Jordan gave another bubbling gasp and slid to his knees, the sword retracting, slipping back out of his body as he collapsed to the ground and revealed what was behind him. A boy carrying a massive black and silver sword stood looking at Maya over Jordan's kneeling body. The hilt was slicked with blood. In fact, he was bloody all over, from his pale hair to his boots, splattered with it as if he had stood in front of a fan blowing scarlet paint. He was grinning all over his face. "Maya Roberts and Jordan Kyle," he said. "Have I heard a lot about you?" Maya dropped to her knees just as Jordan slumped sideways. She caught him, easing him down into her lap. She felt numb all over with horror, as if she were lying at the icy bottom of the sound. Jordan was shuddering in her arms, and she put them around him as blood ran out the corners of his mouth. She looked up at the boy standing over her. For a dizzy moment, she thought he had stepped out of one of her nightmares of her brother, Daniel. He was beautiful, like Daniel had been, though they could not have looked more different. Daniel's skin had been the same brown as hers, while this boy looked like he had been carved out of ice. White skin, sharp pale cheekbones, salt white hair that fell over his forehead. His eyes were black, shark's eyes, flat and cold. "Sebastian," she said. "You're Valentine's son." "Maya," Jordan whispered. Her hands were over his chest and they were soaked in blood. So was his shirt and the sand under them, the grains of it clumped together by sticky scarlet. "Don't stay. Run." "Shh." She kissed his cheek. "You'll be all right."
"No, he won't," Sebastian said, sounding bored. "He's going to die."
Maya's head jerked up. "Shut up," she hissed. "Shut up, you thing." His wrist made a fast snapping motion. She had never seen anyone else move that fast, except maybe Jace, and the tip of the sword was at her throat. "Quiet, Downworlder," he said. "Look how many lie dead around you. Do you think I would hesitate to kill one more?" She swallowed, but didn't lean away. "Why? I thought your war was with the Shadowhunters."
"It's rather a long story," he drawled. "Suffice it to say that the London Institute is annoyingly well protected, and the Praetor has paid the price. I was going to kill someone today. I just wasn't sure who when I woke up this morning. I do love mornings so full of possibilities."
"The Praetor has nothing to do with the London Institute."
"Oh, you're wrong there. There's quite a history, but it's unimportant. You're correct that my war is with the Nephilim, which means I am also at war with their allies. This," and he swung his free hand back to indicate the burned ruins behind him, "is my message, and you will deliver it for me."
Maya began to shake her head, but felt something grip her hand. It was Jordan's fingers. She looked down at him. He was bone white, his eyes searching hers. "Please," they seemed to say. "Do what he asks." "What message?" she whispered.
"That they should remember their Shakespeare," he said. "I'll never pause again, never stand still till either death hath closed these eyes of mine or fortune given me measure of revenge."
Lashes brushed his bloody cheek as he winked.
"Tell all the Downworlders," he said. "I am in pursuit of vengeance, and I will have it. I will deal this way with any who ally themselves with Shadowhunters. I have no argument with your kind unless you follow the Nephilim into battle, in which case you will be food for my blade and the blades of my army until the last of you is cut from the surface of this world. He lowered the tip of his sword, so that it brushed down the buttons of her shirt as if he meant to slice it off her body. He was still grinning when he drew the sword back. Think you can remember that, wolf girl? Of course you can, he said, and glanced down at Jordan's body, which had gone still in her arms. Your boyfriend's dead, by the way, he added. He slid his sword into the scabbard at his waist and walked away, his boots sending up puffs of ash as he went.
Magnus hadn't been inside the Hunter's Moon since it had been a speakeasy during the years of Prohibition, a place where mundanes had gathered quietly to drink themselves blackout drunk. Sometime in the 1940s, it had been taken over by Downworlder owners and had catered to that clientele, primarily werewolves, ever since. It had been seedy then and was seedy now, the floor covered with a layer of sticky sawdust. There was a wooden bar with a flecked countertop, marked with decades of rings left by damp glasses and long claw scratches. Sneaky Pete, the bartender, was in the middle of serving a Coke to Bat Velasquez, the temporary head of Luke's Manhattan Wolf Pack. Magnus squinted at him thoughtfully. "Are you eyeing up the new Wolf Pack leader?" asked Katerina, who was squeezed into the shadowy booth beside Magnus. Her blue fingers curled around a Long Island iced tea. "I thought you were over werewolves after Woolsey Scott." "I'm not eyeing him up," Magnus said loftily. Bat wasn't bad-looking, if you liked them square-jawed and broad-shouldered. But Magnus was deep in thought. My mind was on other things.
"Whatever it is, don't do it," said Katerina. "It's a bad idea."
"And why do you say that?"
"Because they're the only kind you have," she said. "I have known you a long time, and I am absolutely certain on this subject. If you are planning to become a pirate again, it's a bad idea."
"I don't repeat my mistakes," Magnus said, offended.
"You're right. You make all new and even worse mistakes," Katerina told him. "Don't do it, whatever it is. Don't lead a werewolf uprising. Don't do anything that might accidentally contribute to the apocalypse. And don't start your own line of glitter and try to sell it at Sephora."
"That last idea has real merit," Magnus remarked. "But I'm not contemplating a career change. I was thinking about..."
"Alec Lightwood?" Katerina grinned. "I've never seen anyone get under your skin like that boy."
"You haven't known me forever," Magnus muttered, but it was half-hearted.
"Please. You make me take the portal job at the Institute so you wouldn't have to see him. And then you showed up anyway just to say goodbye. Don't deny it. I saw you."
"I didn't deny anything. I showed up to say goodbye. It was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it." Magnus tossed back a slug of his drink.
"Oh, for goodness sake," said Katerina. "What is this about, really, Magnus? I've never seen you so happy as you were with Alec. Usually when you're in love, you're miserable. Look at Camille. I hated her. Ragnar hated her."
Magnus put his head down on the table. "Everyone hated her," Katerina went on ruthlessly. "She was devious and mean. And so your poor, sweet boyfriend got suckered by her. Well, really, is that any reason to end a perfectly good relationship? It's like sicking a python on a bunny rabbit and then being angry when the bunny rabbit loses." "Alec is not a bunny rabbit. He's a shadow hunter."
"And you've never dated a shadow hunter before, is that what this is?"
Magnus pushed himself away from the table, which was a relief because it smelled like beer. "In a sense," he said. "The world is changing. Don't you feel it, Katerina?" She looked at him over the rim of her drink. "I can't say that I do." "The Nephilim have endured for 1,000 years, said Magnus. "But something is coming, some great change. We have always accepted them as a fact of our existence. But there are warlocks old enough to remember when the Nephilim did not walk the earth. They could be wiped away as quickly as they came."
"But you don't really think."
"I've dreamed about it," he said. "You know I have true dreams sometimes."
"Because of your father."
She set her drink down. Her expression was intent now, no humor in it.
He could just be trying to frighten you.
Katerina was one of the few people in the world who knew who Magnus's father really was. Ragnar Fell had been another. It wasn't something Magnus liked to tell people. It was one thing to have a demon for a parent. It was another thing when your father owned a significant portion of Hell's real estate. To what end? Magnus shrugged. I am not the center of whatever whirlwind is coming.
But you're afraid Alec will be, said Katerina, and you want to push him away before you lose him.
You said not to do anything that might accidentally contribute to the apocalypse, Magnus said. I know you were joking, but it's less funny when I can't rid myself of the feeling that the apocalypse is coming somehow. Valentine Morgenstern nearly wiped out the Shadowhunters, and his son is twice as clever and six times as evil. And he will not come alone. He has help. From demons greater than my father. From others.
How do you know that?
Katerina's voice was sharp. I've looked into it.
I thought you were done helping Shadowhunters, said Katerina.
And then she held up a hand before he could say anything.
Never mind. I've heard you say that sort of thing enough times to know you never really mean it.
That's the thing, Magnus said. I've looked into it, but I haven't found anything. Whoever Sebastian's allies are, he's left no tracks of their alliance behind. I keep feeling like I'm about to discover something, and then I find myself grasping at air.
I don't think I can help them, Katerina. I don't know if anyone can.
Magnus looked away from her suddenly pitying expression across the bar. Bat was leaning against the counter, playing with his phone. The light from the screen cast shadows across his face. Shadows that Magnus saw on every mortal face, every human, every shadow hunter, every creature doomed to die.
Mortals die, said Katerina.
You've always known that, and yet you've loved them before.
Not, Magnus said, like this.
Katerina inhaled in surprise.
Oh, she said.
Oh. She picked up her drink.
Magnus, she said tenderly, you are impossibly stupid.
He narrowed his eyes at her.
Am I? If that's the way you feel, you should be with him, she said.
Think of Tessa. Did you learn nothing from her? About what loves are worth the pain of losing them?
He's in Alicante.
So? Said Katerina.
You were supposed to be the warlock representative on the council. You unloaded that responsibility onto me.
I'm unloading it back.
Go to Alicante.
It sounds to me like you'll have more to say to the council than I ever could anyway. She reached into the pocket of the nurse's scrub she was wearing. She had come directly from her work at the hospital.
Oh, and take this.
Magnus plucked the crumpled piece of paper from her fingertips. A dinner invitation, he said in disbelief.
Meliorn of the Fairfolk wishes for all the council downworlders to meet for supper the night before the great council, she said. Some kind of gesture of peace and goodwill. Or maybe he just wants to annoy everyone with riddles. Either way, it should be interesting.
Fairy food, Magnus said glumly. I hate fairy food. I mean, even the safe kind that doesn't mean you'll be stuck dancing reels for the next century. All those raw vegetables and beetles. He broke off. Across the room, Bat had his phone pressed to his ear. His other hand gripped the counter of the bar.
There's something wrong, Magnus said. Something pack-related.
Katerina set her glass down. She was very used to Magnus, and knew when he was probably right. She looked over at Bat as well, who had snapped his phone shut. He had paled, his scar standing out, livid on his cheek. He leaned over to say something to Sneaky Pete behind the bar, then put two fingers in his mouth and whistled. It sounded like the whistle of a steam train, and cut through the low murmur of voices in the bar. In moments, every lycanthrope was on his or her feet, surging toward Bat. Magnus stood up too, though Katerina caught at his sleeve.
Don't.
I'll be fine. He shrugged her off and pushed through the crowd toward Bat. The rest of the pack stood in a loose ring around him. They tensed mistrustfully at the sight of the warlock in their midst, shoving to get close to their pack leader. A blonde female werewolf moved to block Magnus, but Bat held up a hand. "It's all right, Amabel," he said. His voice wasn't friendly, but it was polite. "Magnus Bane, right? High Warlock of Brooklyn?" "Maya Roberts says I can trust you."
"You can."
"Fine. But we have urgent pack business here. What do you want?"
"You got a call." Magnus gestured toward Bat's phone. "Was it Luke? Has something happened in Alicante?"
Bat shook his head, his expression unreadable.
"Another Institute attack, then?" Magnus said.
He was used to being the one with all the answers, and hated not knowing anything. And while the New York Institute was empty, that didn't mean the other institutes were unprotected, that there might not have been a battle, one Alec might have decided to involve himself in.
"Not an institute," Bat said. "That was Maya on the phone. The Praetor Lupus headquarters were burned to the ground. At least 100 werewolves are dead, including Praetor Scott and Jordan Kyle. Sebastian Morgenstern has taken his fight to us."
6. Brother Lead and Sister Steel. "Don't throw it, please, please, don't throw—" "Oh, God, he threw it," said Julian in a resigned voice as a wedge of potato flew across the room, narrowly missing his ear. "Nothing's damaged," Emma reassured him. She was sitting with her back against Tavi's crib, watching Julian give his littlest brother his afternoon meal. Tavi had reached the age where he was very particular about what he liked to eat, and anything that didn't pass muster was hurled to the floor. "The lamp got a little potatoed, that's all." Fortunately, though the rest of the Penhallows' house was quite elegant, the attic where the war orphans, the collective term that had been applied to the Blackthorn children and Emma since they'd arrived in Idris for now living, was extremely plain, functional, and sturdy in its design. It took up the whole top floor of the house, several connected rooms, a small kitchen and bathroom, a haphazard collection of beds and belongings strewn everywhere. Helen slept downstairs with Aline, though she was up every day. Emma had been given her own room, and so had Julian, but he was hardly ever in it. Drusilla and Octavian were still waking up every night screaming, and Julian had taken to sleeping on the floor of their room, pillow and blanket piled up next to Tavi's crib. There was no high chair to be had, so Julian sat on the floor opposite the toddler on a food-covered blanket, a plate in one hand and a despairing look on his face. Emma came over and sat down opposite him, heaving Tavi up onto her lap. His small face was scrunched with unhappiness. "Memma," he said as she lifted him. "Do the choo-choo train," she advised Jules. She wondered if she should tell him that he had spaghetti sauce in his hair. On second thought, probably better not. She watched as he zoomed the food around before placing it in Tavi's mouth. The toddler was giggling now. Emma tried to shove down her sense of loss. She remembered her own father, patiently separating out the food on her plate during the phase she'd gone through where she refused to eat anything that was green. "He's not eating enough," Jules said in a quiet voice, even as he made a piece of bread and butter into a chugging train and Tavi reached for it with sticky hands. "He's sad. He's a baby, but he still knows something bad happened," Emma said. "He misses Mark and your dad." Jules scrubbed tiredly at his eyes, leaving a smear of tomato sauce on one cheekbone. "I can't replace Mark or my dad." He put a slice of apple in Tavi's mouth. Tavi spat it out with a look of grim pleasure. Julian sighed. "I should go check on Drew and the twins," he said. "They were playing Monopoly in the bedroom, but you never know when that's going to go south." It was true. Tiberius, with his analytical mind, tended to win most games. Livy never minded, but Drew, who was competitive, did, and often any match would end in hair-pulling on both sides. "I'll do it." Emma handed Tavi back and was about to rise to her feet when Helen came in the room, looking somber. When she saw the two of them, somberness turned to apprehension. Emma felt the hair on the back of her neck rise. "Helen," Julian said, "what's wrong?" "Sebastian's forces attacked the London Institute." Emma saw Julian tense. She almost felt it, as if his nerves were her nerves, his panic her panic. His face, already too thin, seemed to tighten. though he kept the same careful, gentle grasp on the baby. "Uncle Arthur?" he asked. "He's all right," Helen said quickly. "He was injured. It'll delay his arrival in Idris, but he's all right. In fact, everyone from the London Institute is all right. The attack was unsuccessful." "How?" Julian's voice was barely a whisper. "We don't know yet. Not exactly," said Helen. "I'm going over to the guard with Aline and the consul and the rest to try to figure out what happened." She knelt down and stroked her hand over Tabby's curls. "It's good news," she said to Julian, who looked more stunned than anything else. "I know it's scary that Sebastian attacked again, but he didn't win." Emma met Julian's eyes with hers. She felt as if she ought to be thrilled at the good news, but there was a tearing feeling inside her, a terrible jealousy. Why did the inhabitants of the London Institute get to live when her family died? How had they fought better, done more? "It's not fair," Julian said. "Jules," said Helen, standing up, "it's a defeat. That means something. It means we can defeat Sebastian and his forces. Take them down, turn the tide. It will make everyone less afraid. That's important." "I hope they catch him alive," said Emma, her eyes on Julian's. "I hope they kill him in Angel Square so we can all watch him die, and I hope it's slow." "Emma," said Helen, sounding shocked, but Julian's blue-green eyes echoed Emma's own fierceness back to her without a hint of disapproval. Emma had never loved him so much as she did in that moment, for reflecting back to her even the darkest feelings in the depths of her own heart. The weapon shop was gorgeous. Clary never thought she would have described a weapon shop as gorgeous before, maybe a sunset or a clear night view of the New York skyline, but not a shop full of maces, axes, and sword canes. This one was, though. The metal sign that hung outside was in the shape of a quiver, the name of the store, Diana's Arrow, inscribed on it in curling letters. Inside the shop were blades displayed and deadly fans of gold and steel and silver. A massive chandelier hung from a ceiling painted with a rococo design of golden arrows in flight. Real arrows were displayed on carved wooden stands. Tibetan longswords, their pommels decorated with turquoise, silver, and coral, hung on the walls alongside Burmese dar blades with hammered metal tangs in copper and brass. "So what brought this on?" Jace asked curiously, taking down a naginata carved with Japanese characters. When he set it on the floor, the blade rose over his head, his long fingers curving around the shaft to hold it steady. "This desire for a sword." "When a 12-year-old tells you the weapon you have sucks, it's time to change it up," said Clary. The woman behind the counter laughed. Clary recognized her as the woman with the tattoo of the fish who had spoken out at the council meeting. "Well, you've come to the best place." "Is this your shop?" Clary asked, reaching to test the point of a longsword with an iron hilt. The woman smiled. "I'm Diana, yes, Diana Rayburn." Clary reached for the rapier, but Jace, having leaned the naginata against the wall, shook his head at her. "That claymore would be taller than you, not that that's hard." Clary stuck her tongue out at him and reached for a short sword hanging on the wall. There were scratches along the blade, scratches that on closer examination she could see were clearly letters in a language she didn't know. "Those are runes, but not Shadow Hunter runes," said Diana. "That's a Viking sword, very old, and very heavy." "Do you know what it says?" "Only the worthy," said Diana. "My father used to say you could tell a great weapon if it had either a name or an inscription." "I saw one yesterday," Clary recalled. "It said something like, 'I am of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal.'" "Cortana?" Diana's eyes lit up. "The Blade of Ujie. That is impressive, like owning Excalibur or Kusanagi no Tsurugi. Cortana is a Carstairs blade, I think. Is Emma Carstairs, the girl who was at the council meeting yesterday, the one who owns it now?" Clary nodded. Diana pursed her lips. "Poor child," she said, "and the Blackthorns, too. To have lost so many in a single sweeping blow, I wish there was something I could do for them." "Me too," Clary said. Diana gave her a measured look and ducked down behind the counter. She came up a moment later with a sword about the length of Clary's forearm. "What do you think of this?" Clary stared at the sword. It was undoubtedly beautiful. The crossguard, grip, and pommel were gold-chased with obsidian, the blade a silver so dark it was nearly black. Clary's mind ran quickly through the types of weapons she had been memorizing in her lessons. Falchions, sabers, back swords, long swords. Is it a cinquedia? She guessed. It's a short sword. You might want to look at the other side, said Diana as she flipped the sword over. On the opposite side of the blade, down the center ridge, ran a pattern of black stars. Oh. Clary's heart thumped painfully. She took a step back and nearly bumped into Jace, who had come up behind her, frowning. That's a Morgenstern sword. Yes, it is. Diana's eyes were shrewd. Long ago, the Morgensterns commissioned two blades from Wayland the Smith, a matched set, a larger and a smaller, for a father and his son. Because Morgenstern means morning star, they were each named for a different aspect of the star itself. The smaller, this one here, is called Heosphorus, which means Dawnbringer, while the larger is called Phosphorus, or Lightbringer. You have doubtless seen Phosphorus already, for Valentine Morgenstern carried it. And now his son carries it after him. You know who we are, Jace said. It wasn't a question. Who Clary is. The Shadowhunter world is small, said Diana, and she looked from one of them to the other. I'm on the council. I've seen you give testimony, Valentine's daughter. Clary looked doubtfully at the blade. I don't understand, she said. Valentine would never have given up a Morgenstern sword. How do you have it? His wife sold it, Diana said, to my father, who owned the shop in the days before the uprising. It was hers. It should be yours now. Clary shuddered. I've seen two men bear the larger version of that sword, and I hated them both. There are no Morgensterns in this world now who are dedicated to anything but evil. Jay said, there's you. She glanced over at him, but his expression was unreadable. I couldn't afford it anyway, Clary said. That's gold and black gold and adamas. I don't have the money for that kind of weapon. I'll give it to you, said Diana. You're right that people hate the Morgensterns. They tell stories of how the swords were created and contain deadly magic to slay thousands at once. They're just stories, of course, no truth to them, but still. It's not the sort of item I could sell elsewhere, or would necessarily want to. It should go to good hands. I don't want it, Clary whispered. If you flinch from it, you give it power over you, said Diana. Take it and cut your brother's throat with it, and take back the honor of your blood. She slid the sword across the counter to Clary. Wordlessly, Clary picked it up, her hand curling around the pommel, finding that it fit her grip. Fit it exactly as if it had been made for her. Despite the steel and precious metal in the sword's construction, it felt as light as a feather in her hand. She raised it up, the black stars along the blade winking at her, a light like fire running, sparking along the steel. She looked up to see Diana catch something out of the air, a glimmer of light that resolved itself into a piece of paper. She read down it, her eyebrows knitting together in concern. By the angel, she said. The London Institute's been attacked. Clary almost dropped the blade. She heard Jace suck in his breath beside her. What? He demanded. Diana looked up. It's all right, she said. Apparently there's some kind of special protection laid on the London Institute, something even the council didn't know about. There were some injuries, but no one was killed. Sebastian's forces were rebuffed. Unfortunately, none of the Undarkand were captured or killed either. As Diana spoke, Clary realized that the shop owner was wearing white mourning clothes. Had she lost someone in Valentine's War? In Sebastian's attacks on the Institutes? How much blood had been spilled by Morgenstern hands? I'm so sorry, Clary gasped. She could see Sebastian, see him clearly in her head, red gear and red blood, silver hair and silver blade. She reeled back. There was a hand on her arm suddenly, and she realized she was breathing in cold air. Somehow, she was outside the weapon shop on a street full of people, and Jace was beside her. Clary, he was saying, it's all right, everything is all right. The London Shadowhunters, they all escaped. Diana said there were injuries, she said. More blood spilled because of Morgenstern's. He glanced down at the blade, still clutched in her right hand, her fingers bloodless on the hilt. You don't have to take the sword. No, Diana was right. Being afraid of everything Morgenstern, it gives Sebastian power over me, which is exactly what he wants.
I agree, Jay said. That's why I brought you this.